Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. The first thing I'm going to do is just throw out a quick reply to an email that came in this week from Randa in Aptos. And Randa, I just want to let you know that you do not need to rush into therapy based on the numbers that you gave me in your email. I do think that you need a more thorough workup, and as you indicated you would come in and see me, I would urge you to do that, and I will have my office reach out to you by email. Okay, moving on to email. This from Aaron in Indianapolis. Aaron writes, osteoporosis and serum vitamin D levels reclassed and exercise. It's a fairly long email. I'm going to read the whole thing. I just learned my 59-year-old sister has osteoporosis. She's 5'9", 127 pounds. She is Caucasian, has less than 4 drinks a week, has never smoked, hasn't used glucocorticoids, and while our 81-year-old mother has osteoporosis, she has not had a hip fracture, and neither she nor my sister have kyphosis. My sister recently had a reclassed infusion, and even a week later is still having flu-like symptoms. She's not excited about having to do this again every year. I use the Frax tool to look at her data. It only looks at the femoral neck, and with her 10-year risk of a hip fracture only minus 1.1, and other major osteoporotic fracture is 7.9, he does give her T-scores, and her lumbar T-score is minus 2.9. The fact that her lumbar score is minus 2.9 is the major issue. It sounds as if that requires treatment regardless of the Frax score. Her thyroid levels are apparently normal. Just parenthetically, I want to say that Aaron has done a very good job of anticipating much of what I would have said. And reading on, her vitamin D level is 28.3. I suggested she should increase that number to be closer to 50. Her endo has her on 1,000 units a day, but 28.3 seems rather low, especially now that she's on a bisphosphonate. I'm trying to find good research about higher levels of D being appropriate for someone with her risk factors, but it's difficult to find. Even on Google Scholar, I'm running into unclear results. I know from listening to your show for years that many studies with vitamin D are poorly done and frequently have confounding issues. What guidance would you have and what research are you aware of that I could share with her regarding appropriate vitamin D levels? Also, what do you think about reclass? She doesn't want monthly injections of another bisphosphonate, but I'm not sure why oral meds aren't being used. Since I have osteopenia, I'm very interested in doing everything I can to keep my scores level. My D levels are around 50, and I've been jumping rope, taking tat dats in class, and doing some overhead presses with 20-pound free weights. What other strategies can we incorporate? Thank you. I love your show, quote you all the time, and share episodes regularly with family and friends. Well, thank you, Aaron. And I'm glad I may have contributed to some of the things you did already for your sister, and particularly paying attention to her risk factors. So let's start with the vitamin D level. Actually, if you go to the standard recommendations, like the U.S. Health Services Task Force on what the right thing to do is, or just any of the nutrition literature, you'll find that the normal vitamin D has been moved up to 30. So by definition, her vitamin D levels are low. I just don't think her endo maybe has gotten the memo. I think that she should be closer to 50. I think that is the sweet spot for all sorts of people. Again, emphasizing, we call it vitamin D, but we should be calling it cholecalciferol because it's a hormone. It's, in fact, a steroid hormone, like estrogen, like cortisol. And so, because it's a hormone, it has impact all over the body. We know it has a great impact in the gut, both as an anti-inflammatory and for increasing absorption of calcium. Another thing that you have not mentioned, but which I would strongly emphasize, is taking some calcium supplements and taking some vitamin K2. And you want to get that subcomponent of vitamin K2 called MK7, 8, and 9. And it could be any one of those, but you should be getting 150 to 200 micrograms of that. And vitamin K2 is widely available in health food stores. There is no known upper limit of vitamin K2, so you really can't overdose on this. It takes a blood level of about 110 to get into trouble with vitamin D. There's vitamin D toxicity is actually extremely rare and hard to, but, and I have had people misled or misleading themselves into taking 10,000, 15,000 units of vitamin D for a period of time. And they've come into my office with that on their medication list and their levels are 110. And I ask them to let their levels drop to below 90. As always, with steroid hormones in particular, you want to be careful about overdosing on hormones. And it's important to know that too much can often turn off the receptors, similar in effect to the way too much insulin causes insulin resistance. Too much estrogen will cause tissue estrogen resistance as a defense mechanism. Too much vitamin D, will that cause vitamin D receptor resistance? And if so, at what level? And the answer is nobody knows because nobody's looked at it. But I think it is reasonably plausible to think that hormones are going to exhibit similar properties. So I do worry a little bit about doses that get the levels above 90. I think that gives you plenty of headroom. Now, you mentioned the reclass, which is the annual shot of that's given for osteoporosis. She does technically have osteoporosis of the spine, and it is possible that she could suffer painless spinal fractures or even painful spinal fractures. So this is something that needs to be addressed. I would recommend these other things as well as the bisphosphonate. But I see no reason not to do oral bisphosphonates. Up until recently, that's all we had. And there is a trick to them. And I think it might require an extra 5 minutes to explain to the patient how to take the drug. And maybe that's why the doctor just goes with the shot. Possibly there's some financial secondary gain there. I absolutely do not know. But what I can tell you is that there is a monthly, there is a weekly bisphosphonate that works very well, and that is Fosamax, which is taken once a week on an empty stomach, and the only proviso for that is that you can't eat or drink anything for an hour. Now, people who are on thyroid medication figure out how to do that every day. So I call it the prayer to the bone goddess. Once a day, I recommend Sunday, but, could be Saturday if you're of a different faith. And as part, you just sort of say a prayer to the bone goddess. You get up and you fast and you drink water for an hour and you take your medication and you don't do any downward dog or lie back down. You just stay upright. People who have Barrett's esophagus or bad esophagitis will find this practice untenable because it is an irritant in the esophagus, and people who have a lot of reflux are likely to irritate their esophagus. But the vast majority of people do very well on it, and the once a week treatment is just as effective in maintaining the bones as the annual reclass shot. So you're trading maybe a mild hassle, but at least you don't feel like you've got the flu for a week. I would consider that to be a very good reason not to take that shot again. That's an adverse drug event. And why push your luck? So as far as the higher levels of vitamin D are concerned, you want to, and that being appropriate, it's appropriate for way more It's appropriate for all individuals, not specifically those with osteoporosis. Because she is very tall and relatively thin, I would wonder about the I would wonder about her gut and her absorption and whether there was an issue there. You say that your mother has osteoporosis but has not had a hip fracture. That's important because you inherit structure as well as other things. And the structure of the bone can itself improve the or reduce the fracture risk, improve the strength of the bone just by the way it's built. Something like that geodesic dome that Buckminster Fuller created. You push on one side and the other side pushes back, and so it stabilizes the organism with very little material. Well, thin bones that are properly structured internally actually have more strength. And we learned by making mistakes in medicine that taking something like strontium, which improves your bone scan, so your DEXA gets better when you take strontium, but it increases the apparent density of the bone, but it does not improve the fracture rate. And so we had to wait 10 or 15 years to disprove the idea that strontium was going to help people. And I was in on that one because the initial data on strontium looked like it was really helping bone density. And it was. It just wasn't helping bone stability. So based on the data as I currently see it, I believe that my recommendations are appropriate, and I hope that she will consider them. Got a call coming in, so we'll just pick that right up. Hello, this is Dr. Don. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
John from Santa Cruz.
Oh, hello, John from Santa Cruz. Talk to me. Tell me how I can help you today.
I have a question about postural hypotension. I've been developing that type of a symptom more in the past few months. If I'm waking up in the morning, I go from recumbent to seated position with the legs still in bed, and I get really dizzy. And I'm pretty sure the next symptom came about because of the increased heat. That is, I've gotten up too fast three times within the past one or two weeks and completely fainted.
Oh, gone. Okay.
And so with that, is it looking like postural hypotension?
Well, let me just ask a couple of questions. First of all, are you on any medications, prescription medications?
None.
And have you started any kind of new supplement or herbal programs recently?
None.
Okay. Do you drink a goodly amount of fluid, a couple of liters a day?
Actually, I don't. And I know that I've got a Nordic track, so I'm looking at getting more muscular strength through the Nordic track. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped drinking coffee about a year and a half ago, and I was wondering, should I get back on coffee for two reasons, the liquid in the morning and caffeine?
Well, the problem with coffee is it's a diuretic, so it'll steal water from your volume to be processed. So it's a net negative as far as hydration is concerned, whether it's decaf or caffeinated, because the theobromine and is in the caffeine, but there's other things that are in there that are aromatics and terpenes and all sorts of things that your kidneys have to dilute out, and so they'll steal water from your bloodstream to do that. It was very hot a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people got just heat illnesses, you know, not necessarily heat stroke, but heat prostration types of symptoms where they would get faint and lightheaded. The thing that worries me about your symptoms is you said when you sit up and your legs are still in bed, so you're essentially turning into an L shape, right?
Yeah.
And
correct.
That is very unusual for people to get dizzy from doing that if it's a postural indication. Okay. Is when you say dizzy, let's clarify, is it sort of a floaty or a sinking sensation, or is it more of a spinning or a moving forward or sideways sensation?
Brain spinning.
Definitely spinning?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So I actually think that it's an inner ear problem that you may have developed. Oh. And so and you may also have dehydration, which isn't helping your blood pressure when you stand up. You could have two problems.
Thank you.
But definitely when your leg's still in bed, when you said that, I went, ding, that does not fit with postural hypotension, but it does fit with vestibular problems. There is a good possibility that you've broken loose one of the little rocks in your semicircular canals. These are essentially carpenter's levels, circular tubes that are lined with hair. And on top of the hair, there's goo. And on top of the goo, there's little rocks called otoliths. And these little rocks essentially the whole thing is floating in fluid. And when you roll that circular tube, in the case of a carpenter's level, the bubble's going to move to the right or the left, and you'll know that you're not level. In the case of these, the floor where the hairs are planted on moves, but the rocks have inertia, and so they drag the fibers sideways, and that stimulates the sensation of movement. And then as soon as you stop moving, the fibers stand up straight, and it turns off the sensation of moving. But if any of the rocks break loose and they keep springing around and landing on this very sensitive neurologic surface, what happens is that the persistence of the sensation of movement occurs. So we want you to check that by being seated in a chair with arms and try moving your head, nodding and throwing your forehead back three or four times, and then closing your eyes and seeing if you induce that sensation, which I'm betting you will.
Uh-huh.
And then there are some exercises. You can look up Dr. Foster vestibular exercise online. Or you can send me an email at the AskDrDon.com contact us method. So you just go to AskDrDon.com and click the contact us and request the Dr. Foster handout, and I'll send that to you.
Okay.
And I'm shamelessly promoting her exercise because I think it's a lot better than the Hall Pike exercises in terms of not damaging your neck. So we want to be careful with our necks and not rack them around too much. But in this case, for the single episode that you're doing the testing, it would be a good idea.
Okay.
And then more fluid and more salt. And that will, and especially when it's hot. Did you know that you can lose a liter a day to sweat and not even notice it?
I did not know it was that amount.
It can be. It depends on the ambient temperature and your adaptation. Most of us here in Northern California are not adapted to temperatures over 90, at least not on the coast. I mean, if you're in the Central Valley, of course you are. But a sudden hot day or two can really, really cause you to lose a ton of fluid.
Okay, because I don't do well with heat at all.
Where were you? Where did you grow up?
I've been in Santa Cruz since 1958.
Well, basically, the first 5 or 10 years of your life is when your thermostat gets set. And so my husband lives here now and grew up in Connecticut, and, you know, snowy winters, up at 5 in the a.m. with a paper route, you know, kind of classic happy days kind of boyhood as far as that stuff goes. But he is much better with cold. And I grew up in Los Angeles and learned to walk around when it was 102. You just walk a little slower and drink a lot of fluid and you'll be fine. But the drink a lot of fluid part is non-negotiable.
Okay. I have gotten that.
Okay.
And it sounds reasonable for something to amp up is more fluid intake.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that we're speaking to a lot of people out there about the importance of doing that. I really think it's extremely important right now to be attentive to that.
I might switch the fluid intake in the morning to a glass of water with fresh lemon juice and manuka honey.
Sounds delicious. I do that myself, and I'm very Martha Stewart about it. I've got lemons off my own lemon tree.
And mine too.
And so I, you know, it's sort of like throw a little thank you out to the land as I have my lemons. And I've even started putting my psyllium in there. And because, you know, it's tasty enough and it has no additional additives. So it's not like Metamucil or something like that where they've got, you know, artificial sweetener and non-caking agents and all sort of stuff I don't need. You just, you know, you make it and you drink it and you rinse out the glass and it's all good.
Good. All right. Well, I appreciate your help in differentiating what the dizziness might be with. And again, thanks for being on the air at 90.7.
Well, let's thank 90.7 K-Squid for letting me be on the air, because it's a mutual admiration society over here.
Good. Okay. Thanks much.
Bye-bye, John. Let's do a couple of quickies. More Americans survive cancer in a major milestone. 7 out of 10 U.S. cancer patients now survive at least 5 years after diagnosis, which is up from 5 out of 10 in the 1970s. So this is based on diagnoses made between 2015 and 2021. So if you do the math, that works out to about 5 million cancer deaths that have been averted. And what's the big answer? Well, reducing smoking and major advances in therapies. Among the biggest breakthroughs, we have immunotherapy, which has helped nearly double the 5-year survival rate for multiple myeloma, and targeted therapies in, along the same lines, designed to go after specific genetic or molecular, they say flaws here, but I would say variations in cancer cells, because cancer cells become more like embryonic cells. And those are not flaws. Those are just running the wrong program at the wrong moment. These gene therapies have also extended patient survival. Things like immune checkpoint inhibitors have made a big difference in keeping cancers from being able to hide from the immune system. And although we do see rising rates of breast and colon cancer, especially in younger people, the overall picture is very good for the therapeutics. And Nixon, good old Tricky Dick, is the one who basically declared war on cancer. And this war, I can say, we are winning on the treatment end. And now, if we really want to win this war, we need to work harder on the environmental input end, because it is, of course, those increasing rates of cancer are probably related to decreasing amounts of nutrition in the overprocessed American diet, as well as exposure to the more than 50,000 new-to-nature molecules invented in the aftermath of World War II, when big chemistry really got a boost. So just a quick little note here. An article, large study done on a database of 67,000 adults from 20 to 84 in the Estonian Biobank, researchers found that men's self-reported libido rose through early adulthood and peaked in their early 40s before declining slowly and steadily thereafter. For women, however, desire was highest in their 20s and early 30s. Then it began to decline earlier than men, with a sharper drop-off around age 50. The researchers note that although men's testosterone levels typically begin falling when they're in their early 30s, their libido appears to remain high for another decade. Desire and libido is not driven primarily by testosterone. And, of course, relational dynamics may play a more significant role. Men in their 40s are more likely to be in stable long-term relationships, which have been associated with increased sexual activity and increased emotional intimacy. So probably that's a part of it. I still think it's an interesting statistic, and I would love to do that survey and then subdivide the women's score by the age of their children, because that declining in the early 30s may relate a lot to basically childcare fatigue. As in Estonia, I'm willing to bet that women do a larger share of the chasing after the children, even if they are working. Just a hypothesis. And we're about to launch in to a discussion of perimenopause and menopause. So what happens to a woman's body during perimenopause and menopause? I think that we have a culture that turns discomfort into a disease and then hops right up like a dog trained to bring you slippers with the prescription pad to fix your discomfort. I think it's better to think of puberty and perimenopause differently. They are, in fact, the bookends to a woman's reproductive years, like the curtain opening and closing on a long performance. Just as puberty brought body changes, remember those? Mood swings, hormone surges, skin changes that felt overwhelming, but were completely natural. Perimenopause works the same way. It's not an illness. It's your body's natural transition. Menopause, however, is when your periods stop permanently. This is also a natural transition. And I want to emphasize that menopause, which happens in the United States at the average age of 51, is actually a life-prolonging event. It's important to frame it that way. And it changes it's not I'm getting old, it's I'm getting to get older because I'm not going to get pregnant and be a high-risk pregnancy in my mid-50s, which is exactly what does happen in many mammals. In fact, humans and a few of the primates and a whale and a couple of rodents are the only mammals that actually go through menopause, which is just fascinating. But this is really not two events. It's a transition from point P to point M. And that transition can take up to 15 years before your periods actually stop. Although it typically lasts for about 4 years, it can last a lot longer for some. Here's what to understand about the hormones, because I think in perimenopause, we have this natural idea that things are slowing down. It's not really slowing down. During your fertile years, your body goes through monthly cycles with big swings in two key hormones, progesterone and estrogen. At the extremes, these monthly changes often cause bloating, fluid retention, constipation, and headaches. Perimenopause is a transition, but during perimenopause, the variations in hormones may actually be greater. You may have larger surges of estrogen, and they may occur unpredictably and really kind of shock the body, and then the estrogen may drop to very low or insignificant levels. As you get closer to menopause, the estrogen levels stabilize, and they stabilize at a much lower level. There's still some substantial overlap between what we call the luteal phase estrogen and the menopausal estrogen. So some women will end up keeping estrogen levels that are higher than others. Women who are heavier and have more body fat will tend actually to have less hot flashes because the body fat itself will produce some estrone, which will help prevent the vasomotor instability. And we're coming to that in just a moment. I want to emphasize that your ovaries at menopause stop releasing eggs completely, and they no longer produce estrogen directly or progesterone, although they do make small amounts of testosterone. A lot of the estrogen in a woman's body after menopause actually comes from conversion of androstenedione that's coming from the adrenal glands and then being converted in your body, other body tissues, to estrogen. And that's happening at a very stable level. So you don't have much variation. And so things calm down. But during that transition of 5 to 7 years, hot flashes and night sweats become very common. About half of women get them. Women who eat a lot of soy in their diet tend to get less of them. And that may be because soy itself is a weak stimulator of the estrogen receptor. And a person who's having really bad hot flashes could help themselves by just consuming soy-based foods. I recommend fermented soy or tofu rather than edamame because there's a mild anti-thyroid effect to the steamed, raw, untransformed, and unbiologically transformed soy proteins. So the first sign of perimenopause is generally changes in the cycles. The longer, shorter, heavier, lighter, skipping, all of the above, maybe literally one or two of the above. It varies so much among women based on so many other factors that are unique to them. Sleep problems are also very common during perimenopause. Erratic hormone sleep swings are very disruptive, and this might be caused by the night sweats, but the hormonal changes themselves lead to vasomotor instability, which is where the place in your brain called the hypothalamus, which controls your temperature, gets confused and triggers a chain reaction, which leads to vasodilation. And of course, the hot flashes, which wake you up. Often heart pounding is another part of it, especially at like 3 in the morning. And this affects sleep, which definitely triggers a chain reaction. There are probably other aspects to this since estrogen does get into the brain, and in the brain it's an anti-inflammatory. So with the absence of that brain anti-inflammatory, you can get brain fog and trouble concentrating. Anything that inflames the brain, from flu-like illness to drop in estrogen, can cause brain fog and trouble concentrating. Also, increased pain and increased achiness in the muscles and joints, because estrogen is an anti-inflammatory as well, especially at the high levels that you make in premenopause, and you're essentially going through estrogen withdrawal. Mood changes, well, I think we've covered those, and also changes in the secondary sexual characteristics, the vagina, the urinary tract. Urinary urgency and frequency are common side effects, and these symptoms start in perimenopause, but do get worse. And these symptoms do not go away on their own. There tends to be a progressive increase over time in actually what we call technically an involution, meaning a shrinkage and a return to a prepubescent state of the genitalia, and thinning of the skin. So the estrogen's a growth hormone. With less estrogen, you don't grow, the skin gets thicker. You don't grow as thick a layer, and that has all sorts of effects. So what are some of the things that are non-drug related that people can do to help with these symptoms and with this natural and normal but not always pleasant transition, just like puberty? One of the things that happens after those estrogen levels drop is that in many individuals, the enzyme that processes caffeine becomes less active, which means that caffeine stays in your system longer and it has stronger effects. So caffeine use is also associated with more bothersome hot flashes. So limiting chocolate and caffeine can reduce hot flashes and improve sleep quality, and it's a very important step for women to take. Alcohol is also a confusing issue, but many women find that avoiding alcohol helps reduce hot flashes, so I do recommend it. Alcohol can trigger hot flashes, and alcohol definitely disrupts sleep. It makes you drowsy, but it impairs your sleep quality and prevents you from getting the deepest, most healthful sleep. And spicy foods and hot beverages also can make it harder to handle those hot flashes. So I want to emphasize hormone therapy and give you some comments about that. I think that any woman with vaginal or urinary symptoms should be using estrogen or DHEA, which is a precursor to estrogen, as a therapy for that. I think that it helps reduce your chances of bladder infection because it thickens the urothelium. And bladder infection and urosepsis are some of the biggest killers of us as we get older. That urinary tract with that thin skin is just a nice revolving door for bacteria to get into the bloodstream. Now, moving to going after the body symptoms like the hot flashes, you're going to need to use a stronger dose of either estrogen or a progestin for women who have a uterus. The doses of estrogen that are enough to stop the hot flashes are enough to act as a growth hormone on the inside of the uterus, on that endometrium. And back in the ancient 1960s, when estrogen therapy was first being used, this was not understood. And so we had a burst after about 5 years. We started to see an uptick in women getting cancer of the lining of the uterus, and then realized that in a menstruating woman, she sloughs that lining and gets rid of any mutated cells every month, or she turns it into a placenta effectively, and therefore it undergoes the transitions that prevent it from becoming a cancer. But in the case of leaving that in there and letting it accumulate for 3, 5, 10 years, that offers an opportunity for cancer to occur. So progestins in women who have a uterus are very important. The Women's Health Initiative used a synthetic progestin, and it turned out that that was probably a bad actor with respect to the increases in heart disease and breast cancer that were seen. And studies looking at bioidentical hormones, properly done studies, which weed out people who have latent cancer, because whether it's bioidentical or synthetic, estrogen will make cancers grow. If they have estrogen receptors, it's a growth hormone. So you have to follow people over a long period of time. And when you do that, what you see is when you first start giving estrogen of any form, but particularly this study was using pregnant mare's urine, or Premarin, equine esterified estrogen, I believe. This particular product was cheap and abundant because horses were everywhere and the pee was a waste product until somebody figured out a way to make it a pharmaceutical. But it isn't broken down in the body the same way. And I think the estrogen risk is pretty well established now that it has to do with how the estrogen is broken down in terms of causing cancer. If there's already a small cancer there, it will make it grow faster, which means it will be discovered sooner, which is why you have to study women for a longer period of time in order to deal with that confound. But when that is done, it looks like there's a benefit across the board for using estrogen. And of course, if you're using estrogen, my thought is you're getting a mammogram annually because your doctor is insisting you do it. So you're going to find that cancer early, even if it doesn't have estrogen receptors, and that could save your life. Your body breaks down those bioidentical hormones, estradiol that is bioidentical, and progesterone. Both of these can be derived from plant products and brought into the body and exit the body in ways that are completely equivalent to the natural processes. The synthetic hormones are, as I said, like the pesticides, new-to-nature molecules, and as they go through the liver, they are oral. When they go through the liver, they actually create a risk of blood clotting because as the liver processes them, it as a side effect makes more blood clotting proteins. But if you apply it to the skin or in the form of a patch, it bypasses the liver and goes directly to the bloodstream. And the risk of clots from transdermal estrogen is the same as no estrogen, while oral estrogen increases the risk to about fourfold or 400%. So I would particularly avoid, I don't think I have any women on any oral estrogen, and I have plenty of women who are using estrogen and progesterone for, as far as I'm concerned, assistance with quality of life and probably longevity, as I'm helping them avoid osteoporosis and I'm helping them avoid cardiovascular disease. And the data is pretty solid on that if you take it out 5 or 10 years. So again, I just want to emphasize that perimenopause is a natural transition, and you want to clean up your lifestyle and avoid those things that you were getting away with. Now you won't necessarily be getting away with them. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because as we age, we really need to take better care of ourselves in order to stay in the same place. All right, so Andrea from somewhere has sent an email, and she says, have I done any shows on depression and transcranial magnetic therapy? If so, could you direct me to a place? I could find out about it and what you have to say about it. And if you haven't, maybe you might consider doing it. Andrea, we have discussed TMS therapy on several occasions. Basically, I think our problem with transcranial magnetic stimulation is similar to the problem that we have with the electrical stimulation, in that we've got the machines. We can induce the field, but we really don't know where to point the machines. And what the research is telling us is that it's kind of personal where the targets are. We grew our brains, right? They were kind of half-baked when we're born, or one-quarter baked. There weren't as many levels of synaptic connections. I think the adult brain has 7 levels and the neonate has 2 or 3. And so we built all of this architecture as from the experience that we had after birth, and well, in utero as well. We were building that brain, but we did a lot of building once we got out and had eyeballs and could see things and were moving in physical space and encountering hot and cold and all these variations and hearing words and noticing that, you know, the cat ran away when you pulled its tail and all these things that built itself into a structure. But the experiences vary from person to person, and the brain varies from person to person quite a bit more than we expected. And so the resolution of our devices is good, but the targeting is a challenge. So when you do studies, you do see benefit. It's clearly having some effect. In some people, it has a big effect, and I think that's probably because they just got the targeting right for that individual. In others, it has a less beneficial effect, and I think the theory is sound. The technology is probably adequate to the task, but we just need more information about how to decide where to point. And I'm hoping that functional MRI and some sort of active functional MRI going on while people, you know, look at some sort of prompt or image or something that triggers that in their mind and tells us where to point our point the weapon, point the TMS, we may get better results. So worth a try if you have a place nearby that can work with you, but not necessarily something that is going to replace our current system of drugs and behavioral modification, cognitive behavioral therapy, and psychotherapy. We still have a long way to go before we understand all the factors involved in depression. And the TMS is at the end of the line. As a functional medicine physician, I like to go up to the top of the line and look at the factors that contribute to inflammation and the nutrition, and just make sure that all of the inputs for a healthy brain are actually present before I try to patch something. But that's a cognitive bias on my part, which I freely admit. So I hope that's helpful. And I hope that you find that AI has finally matured to the point where I no longer have this hanging over my head. Well, this is Germaine. Zap your way to altruism. A new study has found that gently stimulating the brain with electricity appears to make people behave more altruistically. Researchers asked 44 volunteers to choose between different ways of splitting sums of money with an anonymous partner. The participants were given an initial ratio, for example, a 74 to 26% split, followed by a second option, say a 62 to 38%, and then were allowed a few seconds to select the split. During this decision, scientists applied non-invasive electrical stimulation to the frontal and parietal lobes, aiming to synchronize activity between two regions. When a higher gamma frequency, between 40 and 90 hertz, was used, rather than a lower alpha frequency, 8 to 12 hertz, participants were more likely to choose the more generous option, which gave the stranger a greater share of the haul. The stimulation appeared to nudge the brain towards unselfishness by altering communication within a neural network involved in social decision-making. Co-author Christian Ruff from the University of Zurich says the study set the stage for future research on cooperation, especially in situations where success depends on people working together. Here's another one, kind of a news of the weird. I like to end with those. Better sleep with conches. If you're one of the millions struggling with sleep apnea, grab a conch shell. A small new study from researchers in India finds that daily practice of blowing hard into the spiral shell can markedly improve sleep for people with obstructive sleep apnea. The researchers taught half the study's 30 sleep apnea sufferers to blow into a conch to make a sound like a horn. You do have to cut the tip off the conch. There needs to be a hole there, but it does make a sort of foghorn sound, and they had the others do deep breathing exercises. After 6 months, the conch blowers were 34% less tired, had higher blood oxygen levels at night, and experienced fewer apneic episodes per hour than the others. The results jibe with a few studies that have found lower apnea incidence among players of wind instruments, which suggests that the act of blowing hard strengthens airway muscles. The study was small, and researchers say further investigation is warranted. Do the researchers ever say that further investigation is not warranted? I don't think so. But conch shell blowing could offer a simple, low-cost breathing technique that could help improve sleep and reduce symptoms without the need for machines or medication. So those of you who have mild sleep apnea, this might be something to think about. There was a bigger study done about 10 years ago using didgeridoos and showing essentially the same thing. If you blow into an instrument against resistance, whether it's a didgeridoo or a conch shell, you are using the muscles in your throat and airway and creating essentially a narrowing of those muscles. So you build a tone in the muscles, and then when you're asleep at night, because the muscles have more tone, they have more resting tone, and it opens up the space, and you get a better airway, one that doesn't occlude quite so thoroughly. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.